to the Vent Room, where respiratory therapists can come and get a little inspiration. I'm your host, Dr. Tabitha Dragonberry.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. So we are on track to keep this party started. And one of the things I always like is to highlight respiratory therapists who've kind of gone into non-traditional roles. And today we're going to be talking to Chris Benitez. He actually started respiratory care at the same time. We graduated right about the same time. So it's been an interesting opportunity to see each other grow in the profession in various ways. I know you had a passion in education. So after being a staff therapist, you transitioned into an educator role, but I do see a lot of respiratory therapists looking for other opportunities outside of what we normally go with education. And you've kind of transitioned more into this clinical informatics role, and now you're a technical analyst consultant at Intermountain mm-hmm. Healthcare. And just could you give us a little bit, like, what got you interested in the clinical informatics side of things, and overall, what is clinical informatics?
So, what got me into it? I mean, it goes way back. Clear back in 2007, I was asked by my manager. My manager said, how we do shift-to-shift handoff reports is terrible. We have these paper cards. You know, you seem to really like computers. Can you try and figure something out for us? So way back in 2007, I figured out using Microsoft Access how to create a database that produced these lovely printed report cards. That actually, that system, even though we're on a whole different EMR, that system is still in use at the first hospital I worked at, which was Primary Children's Medical Center in Salt Lake City. So from there, I finished that up. And then they said, hey, do you want to learn how to, Intermountain has this massive database. Do you want to learn how to query from the database? And you're going to kind of sense a theme here. And the theme is, I don't know how to say no. So I went and I said, yeah, sure, I'll learn how to query this database. So I started going to classes for that. My manager was kind enough to send me to learn how to do that kind of stuff. And so then we finished that up. And ever since I got hired in 2004, they all said, hey, we're going to teach you our old EMR, but we're going to change. And even in the time I was there, I went through two different vendors who we started working with to create our own EMR. So fast forward now to about 2013, 2014. Intermountain Healthcare made the decision to go with the Cerner EMR system. And the Cerner EMR consultants came in the very first time. They said, basically going, hi, we're here to build your EMR. And we're like, well, that's great. And I had reached out to some colleagues through Facebook and I think said, give me your experience with the Cerner EMR. And one of them said, hey, you know, it's just a giant spreadsheet. You're going to hate it. It's terrible. And so I said that in the room of executives, again, my mouth cannot stay shut, said it in this room of executives, said, hey, I've heard that, you know, Cerner is just a big spreadsheet and it's really not user-friendly. The next day, I had a Cerner consultant in my office as the educator showing me what Cerner was. And that's where it all began. So from there, because I was the kind of the pediatric person for helping build the EMR from a facilities perspective, they started inviting me to meetings and helping them gather information. What are our expectations? What do we need built in the EMR? And from there, fast forward just a little bit further, in 2015, we implemented at our first site. And when they implemented at that first site, it went terrible. The poor person who was our application analyst, who I'm still very good friends with and work with today, basically lived there for 24 days straight, slept Ooh. In a chair in the respiratory therapy office. So they came out and said, hey, we need someone to work in the EMR who's a clinician. We don't need another application person who just knows how to. We need someone who can actually go to our end users, find out what they need, and translate that back to the developers. And that kind of stuff always interested me. If you go to what the true definition of clinical informatics, that's what it is. It's building workflows to make the clinical piece function. And so that's where I got into it.
And I think it's interesting because I know when I was working at Children's National, we had a Cerner build. And one of the first things they did was look for team members who'd been there for a while to provide input and work with them to build their build the software for us to meet our needs. And then mm-hmm. many of those clinicians got absorbed by Cerner and actually just started working for them directly. So it's been an interesting evolution of how that is. Because really, you know, when we're looking at ventilators and we're looking at all these other tools, we want clinicians being there in that build and being the ones who are talking about it mm-hmm. because they actually understand what we do. So there has to be this marriage between technology and technical analyst and understanding what it is like to be a clinician at the mm-hmm. bedside, accessing these items and trying to care for patients at their worst moments.
Yeah. I think just the basics of So if you said, what was the first thing I did as in clinical informatics? They basically said the sleep physician up at this hospital that just went live has had a terrible experience. Go and find out what you can do to help them. That was my training. So that's another thing. They informatics does not have great training if you are just coming into it. So be prepared to hop in feet first if you're considering this. But when I went up there, you know, it wasn't a show me the software and show me what the software does do for you. Your first focus has to be show me what you do, meaning the provider. Where are you during your various pieces of the day? Where are you wanting to do your dictations in this case for the sleep provider? And then marrying it so that the system augments them and hinders them less. Where possible, there's always software limitations.
Right. You know, we always can say there's been times where it's like, why can't they just make this simple change? But that simple change really, it looks simple on our end, mm-hmm. but it's all interconnected to all these other things. And one change takes a lot of work. Because clinical informatics provide us a lot of opportunity for data mining, clinical decision-making systems that can mm-hmm. flag us when, you know, SIRs are happening or if they have any of those criteria. So I think that it's a super, especially now with the AI that is becoming available, mm-hmm. That we can be flagged sooner.
Yep.
Because when we're busy and taking care of patients and are in the ICU and dealing with what we do day to day, having those mm-hmm. backups, you know, they're not going to replace us at the bedside, but they can definitely help us identify things quicker and trending than shift to shift for clinicians. Because yeah. many times we're super busy.
We're super busy and we don't have the time to pore over the data. Do we care? Absolutely. Do I look at my ventilator and look back when I was at the bedside, look back at my trends and say, oh, wow, I can see the pressure going up, right? You know, their compliance is becoming worse. But I wasn't comparing that with, okay, what's their white blood cells doing over here? Okay, what's their, you know, what's their chest x-ray looking? Okay, I looked at chest x-rays, I promise. But, you know, all these different pieces, which is really cool. We have an AI right now. It's not ChatGPT or anything. It's something we've been developing with Stanford that looks for early onset pneumonia between chest x-rays, labs, ventilators, things, several things, pushes it all through the AI. The AI says, this is your predictability that you're going to go into a full pneumonia and comes out and warns us ahead of time that says, hey, your patient is going to probably get sicker very soon.
It allows us to be, I guess, more hyper-vigilant and anticipate, mm-hmm. right? Because as clinicians, yes. we anticipate the needs of our patients. I always tell people when I'm training with them, you know, that the traveling from novice to expert, many times mm-hmm. all that is seeing patients and being in situations and seeing what you had to do to get them to turn that corner the way you want them to. And as the years go by, it becomes easier to recognize those things. Mm-hmm. And that AI tool is taking all of those numbers and crunching them out and light yearing your experience ahead to say, hey, you know what, keep an eye on this patient. So I'm never going to really worry that AI is going to take over at the bedside. I know that many years ago we were like, oh, the vent can automatically have a ventilator check. But to me, we have to change the terms. Yes, we can check the ventilator, which is just crunching numbers, or mm-hmm. are we assessing the patient and doing a ventilator mm-hmm. assessment where we're taking those numbers and going beyond just those types of things. So I think that as respiratory therapists, looking at the mindset and what we're saying and what we're mm-hmm. actually doing, because we do a lot more than of the ventilator check per se.
Yeah.
So when we're looking at, you know, I've seen a lot of clinical informatics programs. I don't know if you did any mm-hmm. formal education in it. What would you suggest for someone who might be interested in taking their respiratory knowledge and applying it in a out of the box way?
Okay. Like I said, the first question, did I actually do a clinical informatics program? I did not. My master's degree, and I did go get a master's degree, is in public health. Now, you may say, well, how does public health transition to being medical informatics? Well, either way, you have to develop your observational skills, and you have to develop your persuasiveness skills. When I was a clinical informatics, half of my job was just observing and seeing what they were doing. And then using, again, that experience you're talking about, they say, okay, these are the places where I'm going to get the most bang for my buck. So think about that. If you're evaluating a ventilator, let's take it back to respiratory. You're evaluating a ventilator. Usually you have your tick boxes to say, okay, this ventilator does this, this, and this, and this, and this other ventilator does this, and you really evaluate that. You do the same kind of thing in clinical informatics. You say, okay, well, the business wants X, Y, and Z to occur. If I do X, I'm going to affect 10 caregivers. If I do Y, I'm going to affect 50. If I do Z, I'm going to affect 1,000 caregivers. So which one are we going to work on? And now you have to sell that. You may have a medical director who wants you, oh, I want this one thing, but it's only going to affect 10 people. So now you have to convince that medical director, just like if you're sitting at the bedside, you know, we really should go down the PEEP now. Same thing. But now you're doing it for informatics. So I think if those two soft skills were probably the most important for moving into clinical informatics. And then probably a third skill I would look at is learning a programming language. Now, I don't do a lot of programming right now, like the actual hard, heavy-duty programming. Most of my stuff is GUI, a graphical user interface, is mostly what I do in my application analyst position. But much like respiratory therapy, if you think about respiratory therapy, or think about ventilators, anytime you turn a knob on a ventilator, so I'm going to go back to my educator part now. Anytime you turn a knob on a ventilator, you should know what that knob's going to do and every other thing that it's going to affect when you turn that knob. It is the exact same thing in clinical and application analyst. When I go to create a new field, when I go to change a field, even more important, I have to know or I have figured out what are all the downstream systems that could possibly be impacted. And so if you train yourself to look at it, not just as, okay, the patient's CO2 is 55, I'm going to go up by a rate of 5, or however you would do your calculation to do that. You also have to, okay, if I go up on my rate, well, what's my eye time going to do? What's my, am I going to end up with auto PEEP? You're looking through all those other things. We do it naturally, many of us who are in respiratory therapy. It's the same in clinical informatics, but now you're just dealing with computers.
So with that, what is a typical day like for you? Are you in the hospital all the time? Are you working from home? Is it a combination?
So when I was let me take it from two different ways, because application and clinical analyst, I had a little bit different. As a clinical analyst, I was probably spending about 5 to 8 hours a week in the hospital. Just doing evaluation, teaching people how to use the system, observing things that were going on. Spending that kind of time directly with someone, at least. When it was very early on and we were trying to upload the system, it was north of 20 to 25 hours I was sitting with people. As the system got more stable, I was probably spending about still at 5 to 8 hours, but a lot more time remotely. Now, whether that was in an office building before 2020 or such, even then, even before 2020, I was working a day a week from home. We got most of our work done from home. Now, I moved into the application analyst position in May of 2020 is when I moved into the application analyst position. Being that I am not in the application analyst position expected to be observing those workflows. My role is not to observe the workflows. My role now in application analyst is the clinical analyst brought us back and said, hey, we want to do this. We think this is the way we're going to get there. These are what we want you to build. It's my job to say, hey, this is what you think you want, but here's what you may actually want to do. Converting them from their idea to what's feasible in the system. And then being an application analyst, I actually do the build for the thing. So I go into all the back-end tools and I actually do the configuration in all those places. So now, right now, truly, I am full-time work from home. Our company has actually sold off a building or two with the end of this and has said, you guys are going to be work from home. And, you know, the positives and negatives of that, when, you know, of course, is the 1 minute walk from my bedroom to my office a wonderful thing? Of course, I love it. But at the same time, we still do get together about 2 times a month for a couple hours just to be in person, have that face-to-face time. But, you know, I pretty much at this point, I'm not a support team either. So I'm pretty much a Monday through Friday, 8 to 5-ish guy. They let us work early. They let us work late. They let us work the ways around that we need to get projects done.
Yeah, ultimately, if the work is getting done, that's the main thing. They can tell if it's being done or not.
They can, yes. If I'm not producing a couple we do our chain stretches in 2 weeks, 2 week intervals. And if I'm not producing anything, they can quickly see, okay, we haven't seen you do anything in a couple weeks. Not happen, but yeah, definitely see very quickly.
Right. So do you feel like there's people who might have, like respiratory therapists that have more aptitude for this type of thing? Or do you think this is something that really, if someone digs in, they can be successful in this type of more technical role? Because I mean, respiratory therapists are super technical, but yeah. Mm-hmm. This is a yeah. different type of technical.
I truly believe anyone can do this role. And the reason why I feel anyone can do this role, I was one of the first people for the Cerner side that had, when we went to Cerner, that had transitioned from bedside or educator respiratory therapist to being clinical analyst. I since after that, within a couple of years, had 4 other people, 3 from my department, 1 not from my department, transition and are still working today as clinical analysts. I think one thing that I would say about that is each of them had to get out of their comfort zone. And what I mean by that is I was the primary respiratory therapy analyst. They weren't kicking me out. The second one that came in became a pediatric analyst. The third one that came in became a behavioral health and case management analyst. Did they know what all the workflows were and everything they did in behavioral health and case management? No, she didn't. But if we go back to what I said, being inquisitive, observant, if you're willing to do that and willing to step out, really anyone can do this job, really.
Well, I think it also gives you opportunities to see other data and being able to. I was talking to somebody today and it's like, oh, I've been with this company for a really long time. And though I might get paid more, though I might have better opportunities elsewhere, it's hard for that person to to leave that comfort zone. And mm-hmm. I think many of us are like that. We find a job or a role and we just kind of stay there for XYZ reasons, mostly comfort. Mm-hmm. You know, people inherently don't like change.
Yes.
And I think that that's embrace the change and say, you know what, this is I see a lot of, you know, respiratory therapists, whether they're transitioning or, you know, you can only do bedside care for so long. I remember when I was, one of my roles, I was a clinical coordinator at a hospital and one of my staff members was 70 years old, still
yep.
doing NEBS and having difficulty completing his work because of just the walking and the, I mean, how many respiratory therapists do you know that have had knee replacements? Because it is a rough job on our bodies, yes, including for nurses and those types of things. So when people are looking for an opportunity of using their clinician skills, right? Maybe not directly mm-hmm. as a respiratory therapist, you can still be helping many patients when we're able to look at the data. Now, mm-hmm. when you're looking at journals and those types of things, that all comes from the data that can be mined from our EMRs to be able to make meaningful research and partnering with the clinical analyst and those teams to say, hey, this is what I'm needing. How can we get this easily out of the system? How can we build a report that pulls XYZ yep. data to create research?
Yeah, very, very, very true there. You know, just to be clear, I am not a data analyst. I don't strive to be one either. I tried the SQL thing. I wasn't for me. But that's the whole thing is being an application or a clinical analyst. It's not just about giving your clinicians what they think they need. I mean, what they think they need is very important. But it's also looking down that line, understanding that, okay, if I do a field that is very nebulous and just lets them enter free text, I'm never going to be able to mine that for data. It's going to be virtual. Is there ways to do it? Yes, there's natural language processing and other methods that are out there, but it's very laborious and slow. Whereas if I say, here are your 10 or 15 answers, give you an example. I got breath sounds field. The breath sounds field has 15 answers in it right now. Are there many more offshoots of breath sounds that everyone loves? Sure. Love for someone to tell me the difference between rails and ronchi. But anyway, they are both in there. But we have to go to the clinician. Now, we may have a clinician who feels very strongly, well, this is what this means, and I know what this means. And we have to kind of say that we understand you do. But does the population at large know that? Does having this other answer that you want mean something significantly different to all the therapists, doctors, nurses everywhere? That's the game you play as a clinical analyst when you're trying to help shepherd and guide these people.
Yeah, I remember the debate between coarse crackles and ronchi when we were building yes. out our Cerner build, right? Which one do we use? And we could only get one because they just found that the other option just kind of added some ambiguity to it. And we just had to come to a consensus on what we as a team were going to call it because we weren't going to get both options. So, yeah, I think that it's definitely interesting. I like to hear that, like, really anybody can do it if you put your mind to it and getting out of that comfort zone, because these are opportunities for respiratory therapists who are saying, you know what, I would like that 9-to-5 that isn't in a PFT lab or not in home care, or I'd like to work from home as a respiratory therapist. There's very, I would say, few roles that respiratory therapists can work from home. There's some telerespiratory companies like RT Now, but really most of what 98% of respiratory care does is typically in the hospital, but we're definitely expanding outside of those areas And that's what I always like to highlight, is there are different opportunities based off different things. And I'm going to see if I can get a hold of one of my friends. One of the respiratory therapists that I used to work with, he went to cybersecurity, and he went to cybersecurity in a healthcare organization. Yep. So understanding that is, there's a lot of opportunities where your respiratory care knowledge, though might not be direct respiratory care, is so valuable in a career transition, or, you know, just a twist a little bit.
Yeah. I think I would say two things with that is, number one, I was telling about the people, the therapists who follow me into clinical informatics. And I say follow me, they just got hired after me. I'm not saying, hey, I pulled them over. But they were both in their mid-50s. When they came over. So I want to point out that this is not something that, is a young person's game. Only, you know, I got to be able to really get into this. I really do mean anyone can get into it. Really, I do. That's the first part. Don't let your age or anything like that concern you with that. So, and now I can't remember my second part. They always go away like that.
That age, it definitely creeps up on you. But that's good to know, right? Because a lot of people, again, you get comfortable, and it is scary to transition to something different or something new. But, you know, whether you're at the beginning of your career or if you're a little bit later in your career, there are different pivots that are available that sometimes you have to go digging. Right. Sometimes you have to create your own opportunity. And this is one of those opportunities that you kind of had this opportunity to volunteer, or maybe got voluntold. And with that, it gave you an offshoot that is different than what's, you know, a traditional respiratory care path would be.
And the other thing that I would say is, I mean, this is especially true in my organization, but I think in any organization, a lot of times the emphasis is always on nursing, right? Well, we want nursing people, we want nursing, A lot of times, though, it might say way down in the corner, it says, or clinically relevant experience or clinical experience. I would tell you in informatics, do not be scared away if it says they're looking for nursing. If you show them that you can be pliable, that you can be persuasive, that's almost more important in the fit than being specifically nurse or RT or radiology or whatever. We've been, in my organization at least, we've been hired from clinics that don't involve respiratory therapy at all to the behavioral health and other places, as I referred to.
Well, I think that it's just, there's just more of them in general.
Yes.
Right. And the pool is bigger when you're looking at that. But I think you're right. There are times where I've interviewed for roles that respiratory wasn't even listed, but they saw my resume and they gave me the opportunity to throw my hat in. And sometimes I got it and I didn't take it, or sometimes I wasn't the best fit, but they gave me that opportunity because they saw that I had something within that realm that was relevant. So I think that you highlight a great point. Is even though it might say something, I like to push people's buttons and I like to push the system and prove to me why this profession is better than me. It's not. We work hand in hand, side by side, to care for patients with just a little bit of a different specialty.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what really makes us more, I'm just going to say this out loud, what makes us more unique than nursing. And I think what really helps with the transition of the people I've had is, think about when it's 11:30 at night, the physician says, I need this circuit to connect to this circuit. Go make it happen. Nurses don't get that. Nurses get, oh, I need a protocol. I need you to tell me exactly what to do a lot of times, I feel like. Whereas respiratory therapy, it's like, go figure it out. You got to make these two things fit. And that really helps in what I do now. Because I've got to sometimes take disparate things and say, okay, how do I make the square peg fit in the round hole? That is a daily thing for me right now.
No, that's pretty Right. Like they always call this like the MacGyvers of mm-hmm. the respiratory care world. And, you know, if you're too young to know who MacGyver is, you know, go check out some classic TV.
Go watch some stuff. Yeah.
But we're in ingenuitive. We kind of figure out how to make things happen, whether it's the RAM cannula where it's like, oh, this is supposed to be for oxygen, but look, we can do these things with it. And we've mm-hmm. gone beyond the FDA label in many cases with that. So I think that you're right. We, as a profession, the people in respiratory care, figure out how to do things when it's not always obvious.
Yep. Or designed that way. Yeah. Sorry, yeah.
If you were going to give advice to somebody coming into respiratory care or looking mm-hmm. like first, what advice would you give to somebody coming into respiratory care right now, you know, mm-hmm. post COVID and looking at this profession?
The first thing I would say is to be patient. One of the things that I struggled with my first couple years of respiratory therapy was I was impatient. I'll tell you a story. I got into some trouble. I actually got written up for this. That's another thing I'll tell you. Don't ever be afraid, because if you get written up for something that you can never come back, I can tell you you can't. But I was working in NICU. I mean, right out of school, they put us right in the NICU as the first location at the children's hospital I worked at. Kid was on an oscillator, and they ordered CPT on a kid on an oscillator. And I was taking a report from a travel. I'm like, oh, this is dumb. I'm going to go, you know, convince this MP that we need to discontinue this CPT. So I went and had a conversation with the MP, and I was not the most tolerant of the order. Maybe that's not even the right word, but I was not tolerant of the order. But the MP held firm and said, no, I want you to do it tonight. So that all happened. A couple hours later, 3-4 hours later, my supervisor sits me down and says, you know what? I understand you have a lot of knowledge. I understand you want to do things. But sometimes you're going to have to sit back and learn before you can convince people of your skills. And basically what he was telling me was, sometimes you just got to sit down and shut up and do what the physician says, even though it's not the most effective. It wasn't unsafe, but it wasn't effective. And that really stuck with me. So my advice for new people getting the position is, you come in with a lot of knowledge. You come in with a lot of skills. But be patient in being able to build that rapport with people. Because even as you continue... So then I built the rapport with that group. Then I would build the rapport with the next group. That's what's allowed me to transition from these different roles, is to, instead of trying to be the smartest person in the room, I'm not, but I try to act like it. Instead of doing that, it's to listen and know what the person you're sitting next to really needs. What is it that it doesn't matter, provider, patient. How often do we speak with our patients and we come at them and say, hey, your doctor said that you need to take this, you need to do this, instead of sitting with them for 30 seconds, 45 seconds saying, what do you need? What are the things that are going to make it better for you? That would be my recommendation for new people coming in into it. And then the second thing that I've already kind of said, new or old, don't say no to the scary. When someone says, hey, I need a volunteer to do something. I mean, if you're a brand new therapist and they say, hey, we need someone to learn this new device, volunteer. Take that chance. Yes, are you going to be teaching the 30-year-plus veteran how to use this machine? Does that veteran know more than you about the whole thing about respiratory therapy? They sure do. But take those opportunities and you will gain the respect of those veterans. Because they will see that you care about your profession, you care about your skills, and you're wanting to improve.
No, I think that's all great advice. Well, Chris, thank you so much for talking about your role and how you've kind of transitioned from that bedside care to educator into clinical informatics and now into like an application analyst. Because with that, you're just helping patients in a different way and getting the data where it needs to be so people can make decisions at the bedside and make things better for patients.
I'm an application analyst. I tell them I'm an application analyst and I'm a respiratory therapist. So thank you.
Yeah, I think we're no matter what we do, you're always part of the trenches, and it really does build who you are in whatever role that you choose. All right, everybody, thank you so much, and we'll be looking for another episode coming soon.